1230 AM, W255DN Wausau. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. No ICE agents injured, but one detainee is dead and two are in critical condition after a man fired shots at a Dallas detention center and took his own life. CBS's Omar Villafranca.
The victims, what we understand from DHS is that they were actually arrested as part of an ICE raid. That's why they were in that van. The Mexican consulate says one of them was a Mexican citizen. The other two we still don't know much about.
Poland and Estonia praise President Trump for supporting the shooting down of Russian planes and drones that violate NATO airspace. CBS's Charlie Daggett says in one incident,
the Estonian military says those pilots had their transponders turned off. They weren't communicating with air traffic control. Essentially, they were intentionally ignoring warnings.
A new gene therapy is reportedly the first successful treatment of Huntington's disease. It runs in families and affects the ability to think and move. Professor Sarah Tabrizi.
I am absolutely thrilled and excited that we now have a potential treatment for this truly devastating disorder.
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
98.9 WXCO, Wausau's real news and great conversation, and home for the Todd Allball Show, Monday through Friday from 2 to 4.
A big win for the Brewers. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with Sports Baseball. The Brewers held on to beat the Padres 3-1 in San Diego with some good defense. Jackson Chourio playing left field, robbing the Padres of what would have been a three-run homer. So with the victory, the Brewers have 96 wins for the season. That ties the franchise record set in 2011 and in 2018. The magic number is now 1 to give them the most wins in the National League ahead of the Phillies and could be home field advantage in the playoffs. NFL, the Packers had 5 false start penalties in their loss to the Browns in Cleveland on Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different things, whether it's just, like you said, we got a lot of motions, different things where you got to go on longer snap counts. Sometimes it's the D-line, you know, making, you know, move calls, stunt calls, things like that, where the O-line might, you know, get triggered by that loud noise. So there's a lot of different things, but it's an area where, you know, the whole offense, we just got to do a good job locking in the snap count and just focusing on that.
That's Packers quarterback Jordan Love with Sports on Mike Clemens.
I love playing sports, especially for my school. And that's because school sports are special. It's where it's safe to fail. It's where we're taught resilience, where our fear becomes confidence. It's where we learn to get back up after every fall. School sports are where 7.8 million students go from I can't to I can.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
This is Bull Falls Radio, WXCO.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Quote of the day. A senior foreign diplomat evidently texted a Washington Post columnist after Trump gave his big UN speech. The quote, "This man is stark raving mad. Do Americans not see how embarrassing this is?" And the answer is some, half. The other, you know, really a third are going to be your absolute on board. They're your fives. They drank the Kool-Aid, shot the bleach into the veins, did whatever they needed to do to adore dear leader, our unitary executive, who is a wonderful human being, and we love him so much, and we're so proud of all the work that he does because we don't want to get thrown out of planes. But yeah, there are those of us who are embarrassed by what we saw on the big stage. And if you saw Trump's UN speech, and this is one of those moments where you just go, this is where we are, folks. But if you saw the big speech, it felt more like one of those cringeworthy MAGA rallies just performed on the world stage. He unleashed a torrent of grievance and lots of chest thumping, scolded world leaders for, how did he put it, letting their countries go to hell. He blamed globalists for all kinds of things. And of course, the UN for everything from migration to climate change, which called a hoax and a scam. dismissed climate science altogether, insulted renewable energies, ranted about broken escalators and teleprompters as though those mattered at the UN. And the weird thing is, am I the only one that remembers Trump and his MAGA minions mocking Obama for using a teleprompter? Am I the only one who remembers them acting like it was somehow less masculine, like Obama was less of a man because he had to use the teleprompter? Anybody remember that? Or do I just suffer from having a memory? And the weird thing is instead of any semblance of statesmanship or coming anywhere near having solutions to our world problems, he was only there to boast about, you know, how he viewed us, picked fights. You know, I guess we're going to put some tariffs on Russia, which I'm not entirely against. Pointed some fingers at NATO over what he called the energy hypocrisy and rejected any support for the folks, the people in Palestine. Weirdly, but not surprisingly, Trump fixated on migrants and humanitarian work, called them threats, dared. Seriously, can you look at that speech and say it's anything but unhinged? Now, if you watch fake news, you go over there to the right-wing echo chamber. It was the greatest speech ever. You know, Donald Trump deserves, you know, Nobel Prize. He needs prizes, which he evidently, you know, griped about not getting during his speech. And nobody in the room seemed all that interested in giving it to him. And the weird thing is for any American looking for dignity, decency, or any type of leadership, just another jaw-dropping moment of what an embarrassment. Basically an embarrassing display of bluster that only deepens Americans' growing isolation and the global eye roll that we're seeing. When you're saying that I only do business with people I like, and when I don't like them, I don't like them. Okay. When you go on to say I'm really good at stuff and your countries are going to hell. Basically, to sum up the speech, if I could just real quick, because I am embarrassed by it. It was basically, none of you know what you're doing. You all suck. I'm better than you. We're better than, and it's all, the U.S. is better than all of you. And it's because of me, because I'm wonderful. Anything bad was the other guy. Again, I was right about everything. And you should listen to me. When I say something, you should do it and praise me. Love me, adore me. Shower me with gifts and attention. That was basically it in a nutshell. Now, the weird thing is the American people don't even think he's deserving of the Nobel Prize. 76% of us in a poll, which is a pretty big number in a Washington Post Ipsos poll, don't think Trump deserves the Nobel Peace Prize. 22% say he does. And the weird thing is Republicans are right down the middle. 49-49. You would think the base would be, yeah, our guy. No, because I think they're tiring of the act as well. And as I was watching the speech and I'm sitting there going, why am I doing this to myself? You know, why do I, you know, the people in the room, they have to, it's their job. But why are any of us paying attention to this guy at this point at all? Oh, that's right. He's the leader of the nation. And I couldn't help but think of David Brooks' article recently, his opinion piece, The Era of Dark Passions, of which he basically says, you know, Trump's the master of using anger and fear and resentment and hatred and the urge to dominate, fascistic kind of soul, if you will. And, you know, he talked about, you know, this guy's book, this William Glaston's book, that argues that today's leaders motivate people by fear, not with hope, not with aspirational messages, but with the negativity that we all seem to want anyway. I think he said something along the lines of evolutionary negativity bias, when the reality is, you know, at the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy, if you can keep people scared of their neighbors, fearing that they're not going to be able to keep themselves a roof over their head or fed, you could probably manipulate them pretty good. And if you create an economy that's garbage, that most working people are struggling to survive in, You can get people angry at each other. That's kind of what I watched Trump do, only now he's trying to do it on a global scale. And this is the frightening part in all this, because this stuff sells. It's easy to divide. It's easy to tear down. My grandfather always used to say, you know, any idiot with a hammer can tear down a house. It takes a craftsman to build one. And we've got an idiot with a hammer in the White House tearing things apart. And the weird thing is you've got a media culture that's cheering it on. If you watch that Laura Ingraham, for instance, she was cheering. This is the greatest thing ever. It was a pivotal moment. He was awesome. And you go, the rest of the world is looking at us going, what did you do? What did you do to your country? And I can't help but go, I don't quite know why the rest of this nation doesn't look at that speech and go, there's something wrong. Now, here's the thing. We are in our isolation bubbles. You have people who, they only listen to the fake news. They only listen to the right-wing echo chamber. They're only fed the misinformation. Is that their fault or is it our media culture's fault? And understand, as I've been saying, the murder of Charlie Kirk is going to be used in really nefarious ways. And when we come back, one of those ways just popped up. So I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, Mark Weber is going to be here, a lecturer over at Rutgers University, an education policy specialist, going to share some thoughts on, well, what he thinks of Ryan Walters, the superintendent of instruction in Oklahoma's plan. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, as I said yesterday on the program, understand the right is going to use Charlie Kirk's murder to move their agenda, to push things into classrooms, into churches, into the public square that they want. They're going to, under the guise of, this is what Charlie would do, and this is American values. So I came across a social media post by a guy named Ryan Walters. And you may remember Ryan Walters as the superintendent of instruction in Oklahoma, the guy who wanted to buy the Trump Bibles to fill all the classrooms with Trump Bibles for public schools. Again, a school that's 50th in education, we're going to spend money on Bibles that you could have got for free, but the ones that Trump wanted for $60 a pop. But this video caught my attention, and I want to play just how odd this is. This is the Ryan Walters social media post that's just quite remarkable. Here's Ryan Walters.
I'm excited to announce today that every Oklahoma high school we'll have a Turning Point USA chapter. We have seen the outpouring from parents, teachers, and students that want to be engaged in the meaningful work going on at Turning Point. They want their young people to be engaged in a process that understands free speech, open engagement, dialogue about American greatness, a dialogue around American values. We're so excited to partner with Turning Point USA. with this initiative. For far too long, we have seen radical leftists with the teachers' union dominate classrooms and push woke indoctrination on our kids. They fight parents' rights, they push parents out of the classroom, and they lie to our kids about American history. What we're going to continue to do is make sure that our kids understand American greatness, engage in civic dialogue, and have that open discussion. We will continue to do all that we can to make sure Oklahoma students have the best education possible.
That is, well, in 162 words, I think it was, in a minute, a little over a minute, total BS. And if that stuff is happening, the stuff that he was claiming was going on, isn't that his responsibility? Isn't it his fault? Isn't he in charge? But now going to hand over classrooms to a billionaire-funded front group under the guise of we're bringing free speech. Very, very strange. Very strange stuff. And here to share some thoughts on, well, this video and the assaults on education and what I've been telling you is coming, using this murder of Charlie Kirk to push their radical agenda. I've asked Mark Weber to come talk with us. Mark is a lecturer at Rutgers University, also a special analyst for education policy at the New Jersey Policy Perspective. Mark, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, Rick. Good to see you.
So I look at this Walters thing, and first thing I go, he says the parents are asking for this. I don't buy it. I think this is purely his wanting to score cred points with the MAGA crowd and get some billionaire money into his own pocket, certainly not into education, because after all, Oklahoma is still, if not at the bottom, really close to the bottom.
Yeah, you know, one thing you have to keep in mind about Walters is he started his career as a double dipper. He worked for a nonprofit where he was getting paid, and he did not give up that funding when he became the Secretary of Education, who was appointed by Governor Stitt. So right away, the values that this guy stands for, the things that he believes in, are suspect. There was a very bizarre story about him this past summer where a couple members of the State Board of Education went into his office to have a meeting, and there was a TV, and the TV had nude women on it, and they asked him to turn it off, and he did, but then they reported it later, and then he claimed that he was cleared in an investigation, but there was no investigation. This is a guy who is up to a lot of nonsense. The Bibles, you talked about that. He had this idea that the Bibles could only be editions that had the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, and it had to be the King James Version. Well, it turns out there were two Bibles that were suitable, and both of them have ties to the Trump family. But one is Donald Trump's own Bible, and the other, I think, is the Lean Greenwood Bible that Donald Trump has some relationship to. So it's just open on its face. But you know, I was thinking about who is Ryan Waters, and how do we understand him. You know, the Austin Powers movies, you had Mini-Me, you know, Dr. Evil's little clone. Yeah. He wasn't like Dr. Evil, but he had all of Dr. Evil's evilness just on a smaller scale. That's Ryan Waters to Donald Trump. It's like this Mini-Me version of the self-serving, the Mini-Me version of the nonsense, the clear disingenuousness, the clear lies about American history, about children being indoctrinating. And the thing that scares me is that it's funny to think of Mini-Me. How many more do we have out there? How many more of these guys are running around at the state level, at the county level, at the local level, doing all kinds of nonsense in the name of American values, when in fact they're doing exactly the opposite of what America should stand for?
And I would argue they're doing it in the name of the billionaires who are funding all of this, because ultimately you would have never heard the name Charlie Kirk without having the billionaires who gave him the money to go out and do all this stuff. You know, the fact that we're seeing this kind of infiltration into public education, You know, PragerU is in, a friend of mine said, you know, his kids watching PragerU videos on, you know, slavery wasn't all that bad in this kid's classroom. They're spending a lot of effort, a lot of energy, and an awful lot of money to take over education. And I always said it was about Education Incorporated. They wanted the money from education as well as the message that, they can over misinform or completely ill inform a generation of children.
Right. I mean, one of the things about the Prager videos is that they're just so ideological. And the irony, of course, is that it's set up, the selling point of them is that it's going to break woke ideology being indoctrinated on your kid. And one of the most outrageous ones I saw, they had a cartoon figure of Frederick Douglass talking to kids today, saying things that Frederick Douglass never said, never even came close to anything that he had to say. And the idea that somehow that's breaking indoctrination is bizarre. One thing I want to mention, Rick, when you talk about money, we were talking about this before the segment. The scores that Oklahoma gets on national tests are exceptionally bad. You know, fourth grade reading, 47th in the country, eighth grade reading, 48th. By some other metrics, it's the worst school, the statewide school system in the country. Well, one of the reasons why is it's underfunded. I do work with the Shanker Institute. Bruce Baker is a partner, and he has developed models for looking at school finance and whether schools have enough money to actually educate kids. Two-thirds, 65% of kids in Oklahoma go to a school that doesn't have enough money to be able to teach so that these kids can meet just national average standards. Two-thirds of kids are in underfunded schools. So it's not just about Education Inc., although I think you're right about that, and the privatization of schools. It's also about underfunding the schools, because if they were properly funded, that would mean raising taxes. And who would we be raising taxes on? Those very billionaires that you're talking about.
And so also, I would argue, Mark,
part of a piece.
But I also argue into that. What you end up having are underfunded schools who are looking for opportunities to fill gaps that they don't have funding for. So PragerU, going with Talking Points USA or Turning Points USA or whatever, looking for the corporate, the billionaire-backed groups to come in and fill the gaps, which I'm sure they'll be happy to do. As long as they get veto power over teachers, over curriculum, as long as they get their message in that we the people are bad and somehow billionaires are good, they'll be happy to do it. That's kind of how I see it.
Yeah, it's a twofer. It's a twofer. On the one hand, you get to underfund schools, and so wealthy people pay low taxes. And on the other hand, you get to turn schools into indoctrination factories, which I think is a turning point. That sorry for the irony of the saying that in the last couple of years, I've been studying education privatization for a while now, and the beginning of it in this kind of modern era, it really goes back to segregation and the segregation academies and the civil rights era. In this modern era, it begins with this coalition of wealthy centrist Democrats and wealthy Republicans who are looking to use market forces to try to change schools. But that sort of evolves into actually having money flowing to business interests. And so you see like the growth of the charter school, a real estate market, and all sorts of other things to generate money for, as you said, Education Inc. The next step from that then is privatization going to public funds paying for fully private schools, which we're seeing, of course, in Florida and Arizona.
Right.
But now we're seeing something new, I think, in Waters and some other people. It's not enough just to privatize education. You got to take over the public education that's left. You have to turn that into your indoctrination factory. And so now we're getting things like Ryan Waters wants to have tests administered by PragerU for prospective teachers to find out whether they're woke or not, which is just about the most offensive and bizarre thing that you can think of. This idea that just because you became a teacher, you're not allowed to have personal values, personal beliefs. You're not allowed to have a political sense. You're not allowed to express yourself outside of the classroom. Look, there is no evidence that any belief that a teacher has outside of the classroom automatically translates into bias inside of the classroom. But that is the premise that they're operating from. And this is the large scale project. It's not just about school privatization anymore. It is about taking public education and bending it to the will of the Ryan Waters, of the Chris Rufos, of the, sorry to say it, of the Charlie Kirks.
But here's the thing, and this is where the scary part for me is. You know, Oklahoma has been kind of the center of this push to, you know, Donald Trump said himself, Charlie Kirk is a martyr. To canonize Kirk as some kind of a holy saint that can't be questioned. We're going to turn his words into absolute gospel, even though a lot of them were horribly hateful and divisive. And we're going to put monuments on every college campus. We're going to put chapters of TPUSA in every classroom. It's using, well, what's that old saying? Never let a good crisis go to waste. It's this to push the ideology that you were talking about. And that I said from the beginning, this was going to happen. I just didn't think it was going to happen this quickly because the memorial was just the other day.
Well, you know, I can speak directly to this in terms of education, but I think I'm on pretty solid ground extending out through the entire policy and political arena. There is an infrastructure in place, and it has been in place for a long time, most of my adult life. In fact, maybe even before that. Roger Ailes worked in the Nixon administration, and Fox News was born of his experiences there. Ronald Reagan and the rise of the Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Society and all of these other groups, there is an infrastructure that has taken decades to build, and now it is poised to act when something like this happens. When there is, I obviously goes without saying, but I'll say it again. Charlie Kirk was murdered. It's a tragedy. But to take that tragedy then and run with it, you need an infrastructure that's already been set up. The framework has to already be there. And that's what's happened. And it's going to be very difficult to push back. The one thing in my arena in education that stands out as a stopgap against this is that people care about their schools. They care about their local neighborhood schools. They care that their children are getting a good education at their local neighborhood schools. They like their teachers. They want to work with their teachers. And that is a very, very difficult bond to break. You can pour a lot of money into it. It's still going to be there, and that's what gives me hope.
Yeah, but Mark, the message I get on this a lot is, yeah, I love my teacher. My teacher's great. My kids' teachers are wonderful because we know them. It's all those other bad ones, Mark. It's all the rest of them are bad. It's kind of like the same thing in Congress. My congressman's okay, but the rest of the system sucks. We've been trained to think that way.
Yeah, so then if you've got that situation, what is the best thing to do to promote the myth that there is woke indoctrination because of teachers unions, for example? It's to handcuff the teacher that you like. It's to put a gag on the teacher that you know, the teacher that you trust. And we as teachers, we can't allow that. We cannot allow that. We have the right to speak out. We have the right to defend public education. I believe it's not just a right, it's a responsibility. And so I do think it starts with us speaking up and saying public education matters, defending public education matters, defending American values in the classroom matters.
That's why I like Randy Weingarten's new book title, Why Fascists Fear Teachers. I mean, it's the perfect title because it's the reason that they're going after them with such anger and vitriol, and why we should be pushing back and fighting to help them stand up and fight back. But Mark, I appreciate the time. As always, great stuff. I know I'll be calling again because unfortunately, this kind of stuff isn't going to stop anytime soon.
My pleasure, Rick. Anytime.
Appreciate the time, Mark Weber, a lecturer there at Rutgers University. Also, he is a special analyst for education policy there at the New Jersey Policy Perspective. Check out his website, markweber.com. Want to hear your thoughts. Are you seeing it coming to your school? Would you be okay if PragerU videos were shown to your kids saying, eh, slavery's not that bad? Or if they set up a chapter of the TPSU or whatever it is. Would you be okay with it? Want to hear your thoughts. Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Right back.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, WXCO.
You're listening to 98.9 WXCO, Wausau's home for Matt and Air on Air, weekdays from 9 to 11 a.m.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Partly cloudy sky tonight, patchy fog, and lows in the upper 40s. Sunshine continues for tomorrow and beautiful. Highs in the mid-70s, and more sun in mid-70s again Friday. The dry and mild weather is expected to continue through the weekend into early next week. Currently at 62 degrees.
Ahoo, this is Robert Pilot of Native Roots Radio. On our show, we share stories from Turtle Island highlighting the people and issues shaping our communities. From protecting water to treaty rights and preserving languages and traditions, we cover it all. Hear voices like Arvina Martin of Emerge Wisconsin, Dr. Stately, Robert Lilligren, and more. Because Native issues are human issues, and human issues are Native issues.
Native Roots Radio, weeknights at 8 on your local Civic Media radio station.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, you may remember me talking about the Revolution Wind Project off the coast of Rhode Island that was shut down about a month ago on the orders of the Trump administration's Bureau of Ocean Energy Management in the Department of Interior. Well, now you've got this U.S. District Judge for the District of Columbia, this Royce Lamberth, oddly enough, a Reagan appointee. He has granted this Revolution Winds motion for a preliminary injunction. This decision gonna allow the company to get back to work. Let the construction get working, get the people back to work on this $6.2 billion project that's about 80% done. Now, we don't know if the Trump administration is going to appeal. That could be down the road. Lamberth didn't stay the order, so that's possible. But this project can, as I understand of this moment, move forward. That's why I've asked Brent Booker to come talk with us. Brent is the general president of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America. You can check out their website at liuna.org. Brent, thanks for taking time for us.
It's great to be on your show again, Rick. Thanks for having me.
So is this a big deal?
It is a big deal. We've got our members are going back to work. The court system yesterday provided a pathway for our people to go back to work. We've been working side by side with Ørsted for the last month to make sure that, you know, if we got the opportunity to put people back to work, we were going to be able to safely get them back over water as soon as possible. The court order came down yesterday. We're going to have our members back, you know, some of our members back on the project as early as tomorrow, and doing everything we can to complete this project. Like you said, it was already 80% complete.
Does this make any sense? I mean, because I keep trying to find a reasonable, rational justification for shutting something down that's 80% done, and I'm not finding it. Is there some reason that maybe someone's whispered in your ear something?
Nobody's whispered anything in my ear. I read the same headlines you do and see the same news clips that you do of, you know, some of the comments that this administration's made on offshore wind. Look, at the end of the day, this is about jobs. This is about promises made of energy independence, of energy dominance, of creating good paying union middle class jobs. And all that was, you know, taken away a month ago with this stop work order. And now that, you know, a month into people being literally on the out of work list at unemployment, waiting to see what their next job's going to be to be able to go back to the project go back and finish it. And at the end of the day, it's creating jobs and letting these people finish a project that's over 2 million hours already completed under this. Let us finish this job and deliver clean, affordable, safe energy and have this energy dominance that was promised to us.
Now, you're a guy who, you know, you've been on the show a number of times. You've always said you're an all of the above guy. It doesn't matter. We want people back to work. This seems to be an area where you guys, the trades and the Trump administration could find some common ground. Are you having conversations about how maybe you let them lick their wounds on this, let it go forward, get finished, and maybe start talking about, like Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont's doing, saying, hey, we're going to work forward on getting some other projects done so we can actually lower energy costs and actually do things that actually help people?
Look, our union's position on energy has been all of the above for quite some time. And we're for nuclear. We're for pipelines. We're for natural gas. We're for wind and solar and offshore wind and SMRs and hydrogen. If it's going to create jobs and going to be done safely, we're for it. And we're going to advocate for it just like we did, you know, I'm in a unique position. I negotiated the project labor agreement on Keystone over a decade ago. I negotiated the MOU with Ørsted on offshore wind. These are projects that create opportunities for our members, for their fellow Americans to go provide energy for, in this case, it was Rhode Island and Connecticut, 350,000 homes in Rhode Island and Connecticut. We're for all of the above. We want it done safely. We want it to be done environmentally soundly. We want to make sure that, you know, we've heard a lot about permitting reform, you know, and this project was fully permitted, privately funded, and 80% complete, and then it was shut down. So we're going to continue to advocate to make sure that we can finish this project and advocate for other, you know, projects that make sense.
Because ultimately, people need jobs. Your members need jobs. Communities need you to have those jobs. When we build things, you know, be it wind farms or be it homes for communities where we have housing shortages, it's good for the economy. It has a good reverberation effect for small business. It seems like something that Trump would be, as he claims to be a builder, it seems like something that he should be all in on. But I'm not seeing it, because I keep hearing about projects being shut down. I keep hearing about, you know, if he doesn't like somebody, he's not going to deal with it. It seems like the wrong environment.
Yeah. And look, that was campaign promises made, right? And they've said, you know, promises made, promises kept. They promised permitting reform. They promised energy independence. They promised energy dominance. They promised good union jobs, good middle class, well-paying jobs. And this whole project, this Revolution Wind, and what they did with that was contrary to every single one of those promises. You look at the reconciliation bill, you know, that is going to shut down, the government production tax credits after July 4th of next year that allows, you know, utilities and developers to build wind and solar. That's the government putting their thumb on the scale and picking winners and losers on energy sources. And you know, that's why we're all of the above. We don't think that the government should be putting their thumb on the scale. We think that, you know, that the free market should do it, and we should do what the president promised of energy independence, energy dominance, and creating jobs. And by cutting and eliminating, whether through legislation or through executive action, you know, these renewable projects, that is not a pathway to energy independence. It's not a pathway to energy dominance. And it sure as hell is not a pathway to creating good union jobs, in this case in the Northeast, but quite frankly, throughout the United States, when you look at the repercussions for, you know, what's going to happen in this reconciliation bill when wind and solar is not going to get those, developers aren't going to get those tax credits.
Yeah, no, where we may differ a little bit is I do think there's a place for government to push new technology, to invest in the future. I do think there's some place for that, you know, battery technology, wind technology. I think there's a way to help us move in a direction that we kind of goose along, not control, not own, not do, but kind of move along with the right incentives, which is...
Oh, I agree with that. We don't disagree on that. I think that's what the IRA did. It created a 10-year path of production tax credits to stand up an industry, and it had a pathway, an exit ramp, and an entry ramp, and an exit ramp, and it was cut short with the reconciliation bill. So I agree with what you said. There should be a place, that some of these DOE loan guarantees are out there that are, you know, that people are talking about today, that have created an environment that has allowed technologies, you know, that have done that. What I disagree with is when, you know, when I talk about picking winners and losers is when executive action is done, you know, to kill a project that's 80% complete.
Okay, because where I was going to finish up with that is it seems to me that really the only real justification for shutting this down is because it was done during the last guy. And this was a Biden thing, so everything Biden is bad, everything Trump is good. That's the narrative. That's the reason. No good justification that it's better energy or it's going to be cheaper doing something else. It's simply, in my view, and you can come along or not, that this was shut down simply because, one, it's something the left likes, and two, it was done during the Biden era.
Look, yeah, and I don't know what the motivation. You might be right. I don't know what the motivation is as to, you know, why this project. All I know is that this project, you know, was 80% complete, 2 million work hours completed, hundreds, if not thousands of people had already worked on this project, the infrastructure supporting this project, the port work, you know, you name it, it's been job creation, and it's changed people's livelihoods, it's changed communities, it's changed, it was going to change, you know, energy costs in the Northeast. And you know, I'm just excited that the court ruled yesterday that they can proceed and that our members and other members of the building trades are going to go back to work tomorrow. And they're going to do it safely. We've been working with Orsted for the last month to make sure that if we got an order like this, that we were going to be able to get people back to work as quickly as possible and as safely as possible.
And that's the good news of this. I mean, so much of what we see in the news today is bad news. This is actually a step in the right direction. This is actually something very positive because those jobs that you're talking about getting people back to, those are good family sustaining wage jobs with health security, retirement security, opportunity for the future. And I know just this past week, you guys held the building trades, held the Women in the Trades Conference, which I have a number of friends who went and talked about how important women are in building things. And I know we don't get that as the narrative of what happens in this country, but we got a lot of women swinging hammers and pouring cement and all that, right?
We absolutely do, and I'll also say we don't have enough. But this weekend, Tradeswomen Build Nations, it's a conference from Trades Futures and North America's Building Trades Unions, gather, you know, over almost 6,000 women from the United States and Canada gathered in Chicago to build some solidarity. We had close to 1,000 laborers, women from all across the United States and Canada who gathered in Chicago this weekend, you know, worked on workshops. They do a parade. It is literally the best conference of the year that I go to. The energy in that room, the power in that room, the solidarity in that room, you know, is going to create an opportunity for us to organize more members. It's going to create an opportunity for us to use solidarity as a verb. And that's what this weekend was, to see, you know, these women from across just not only our union, but connect with, you know, other women in other trades to know that they're not alone on these job sites, know they're not alone, you know, in this construction workforce and in this construction industry, and then create some real positive energy and real positive vibes that we build off of this conference every year. And every year it gets bigger and bigger. And every year we have more and more women go to it. So it literally is the best conference I go to every year. And it's great. And it's almost 1,000 laborers showed up in Chicago and learned from each other and building a network to call upon and rely upon. If they're having a rough day, they got someone they can call.
Because the reality is we got a lot of work to do in this country. We got a lot of rebuilding to do. A lot of infrastructure needs to be rebuilt. A lot of future technology needs to be upgraded to. There's a lot. And sadly, and this is where, you know, I finally people are coming around to what we've been talking about on this show for now 20 years. We need to be focusing on getting people into those jobs, the skills that they need. You know, my kid's trying to get into one of the building trade programs as we speak, because that's going to be the future. Those are going to be the jobs that aren't going to be AI'd out the door. Those aren't going to be the jobs that are going to be easily offshored. Those are going to be good, solid, family-sustaining wage jobs if we keep them union jobs. So for me, that's kind of what I saw over the weekend.
And that's exactly what happens over the weekend. And you know, again, you look at, and you've heard me say on the show before, we have a goal. I've set a goal. Our march to 1 million members, and I want to double the membership of this union. We can't do it without a dramatic increase in women in the trades. We can't do it without a dramatic increase of women laborers. And our best organizers, our best recruiters are women who are working today and go out into their community, into their family, talk to them about, you know, a career in the construction trades, what it looks like. you know, like you said, to be able to use their hands, to use the skills that they've been taught in world-class training facilities, to then look back and talk to their, you know, their spouse or their children or their grandchildren and look behind them and say, I built that. I built that bridge. I built that building. I built that infrastructure. They're our best organizers. Yeah. And to be able to bring them all together and put them under one roof and share ideas and share growth strategies, it's a very empowering weekend with energy in that room that I don't see in any other room across North America.
Now, every time I have someone like you come on and talk and we talk about this, I always get people go, well, why is this important? Why do I care about this? For me, I think it's important that we, I've said for years, if we want to reunite this country, we've got to reunionize this country. We've got to rebuild this country. If we build things together, I think we come back together. So for me, I think this kind of a conversation, this kind of a direction that you're talking about, I think is really important in how we're going to bring this country back together, as opposed to continuing to allow us to be divided and ripped to shreds.
I agree wholeheartedly. And one of the best things about this weekend is to use my ears a whole lot more than I use my mouth and shut up and listen and hear the personal stories, some strife, some struggle. Everybody has a different pathway into our union, and to hear how, you know, LIUNA has changed their life for the better and how it's provided an opportunity for their family. We introduced a maternity leave policy for the first time, and to be able to provide a benefit. So, you know, a female laborer doesn't have to choose between her health and her career, to allow her to, you know, stay home for the last 6 weeks of her pregnancy and pay her a benefit, and then give her another benefit after the baby's born so she can bond with that child. And then come back to work and use that, like I said, as an organizing tool. Use it, you know, as a way to grow this union and to bring more people, you know, into this union and talk to them about the importance and the values of, you know, of this union and all the other building trades unions and how they're a pathway to the middle class. And like I said, we cannot reach our goals of membership growth without a drastic number of more women in there. And this weekend is that stepping stone every year to create the environment to organize more women into our trade.
So last question I've got for you, or really last statement I've got for you, because, you know, the labor movement's full of stories. I've got my story. You've got yours. They're all of them out there. And I don't think we share them enough. I don't think people take enough pride in the journey that they've made. Anything this weekend that you came across, someone shared with you that's kind of stuck with you?
Look, and you know, from this weekend, I was on some job sites in New York last weekend. It's just hearing the stories, hearing how they found this union, hearing, you know, where they were before they were a construction craft laborer and where they're at now. And I've heard, and I heard this weekend, you know, women who you know, really came from some really tough spots, you know, whether it was, you know, domestic abuse, whether it was poverty, whether it was, you know, not having the chance to, you know, to earn a living, to finding their way into this union. Now they own a house. Now they're married. They have a child or two children. They have a new car. Hearing that story over and over again, you know, and the impact that this union, that the agreements that we negotiate, that the path that they take, the hard work that they do, it's empowering. And we're trying to do a better job, Rick, of highlighting these stories and getting out on social media and highlighting our members so that, you know, people see them, they look like them, that story resonates with them. And that's why I say that they're literally our best organizers of just telling their story. And we're doing everything we can to highlight that and tell that story where anybody will listen, in some places where they don't listen to us, but we're going to keep telling it.
Good on you. You guys do fabulous social media stuff, especially around telling those stories. Brent Booker, I appreciate the time. Good stuff. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
Brent Booker, General President of LIUNA, the Laborers Union of International Union of North America. Check out their website, liuna.org. I want to hear your thoughts. You got a story for me? You're going to share something that says, hey, this is how I made it? I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1918. That was the day that the Industrial Workers of the World Union was banned in Canada. The Industrial Workers of the World Union had grown steadily in Canada, reaching as many as 10,000 members by 1911. The union was especially strong in mining, logging, and the textile industry. But backlash against the radical union was mounting in the United States and in Canada. Swept up in Red Scare hysteria, the governments of both nations targeted the IWW. With the beginning of World War I, labor unions that dared to threaten strikes or to speak out against militarization were met with harsh reprisals. By 1914, the Canadian IWW had less than 1,000 members. In May of 1918, 18 Canadian IWW leaders were arrested while they attended a meeting in Ottawa. Those arrested were immigrants and were sent to a labor internment camp. Then the Canadian government moved to ban the organization altogether. The ban against the IWW would last until the end of World War I. Those found to be affiliated with the union faced up to 5 years in prison. 13 other organizations were also banned in Canada, including the Chinese Labor Association and the Social Labor Party. The act further read that it was illegal to attend meetings, except religious services, during the present war at which the proceedings are conducted in the language of any country with which Canada is at war, or in the languages of Russia, Ukraine, or Finland. After the war, the IWW was once again allowed in Canada and slowly began to rebuild. But the scars inflicted during the war years took a lasting toll on the union's membership. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So we're making measles great again. That's right. Measles are back. And the weird thing is, you know, what we learned about vaccines, when you vaccinate people, things tend to go away. But when you start not vaccinating them, guess what? They come back. And evidently one of the largest outbreaks of measles right now, centered in the area of southwestern Utah and Arizona. Evidently in southwestern Utah, there are, I guess, all but one of the 23 confirmed cases. There are people who are unvaccinated. And you go towards Mojave County, Arizona. I guess it's none of the 42 confirmed cases have been vaccinated. So, yeah. And it's going to get worse because you've got people who are believing this administration, because evidently now acetaminophen causes autism. First, it was vaccines. If you remember, and this is how I learned about RFK Jr. Years ago, when my daughter was born, the whole Tamiflu thing was going on. RFK Jr. was really pushing, was in the news all the time, scaring young parents. I was an older parent, so didn't scare as easy. Actually went to a doctor. Had a relationship with our doctor, said, hey, explain this to me. And she did a really good job of walking us through all of the studies, gave us some to read, actual research. Didn't have YouTube back then. Couldn't go, oh, I'm going to watch a video while on the can. So I actually had to read some stuff. Went back to ask some questions. We ultimately vaccinated our children because like anything, there's going to be a risk. And it's the risk of not doing something is greater than the risk of doing it. So clearly you do it. Now, we have an administration, the Trump administration with RFK Jr. saying now autism, Tylenol, acetaminophen, that's it. And the weird thing is now you've got like the American College of Emergency Physicians put out a statement saying that Tylenol, acetaminophen, is the most effective. You've got a medical institution, defending a company, a drug company. It said most effective and safe first-line treatment for fever and acute pain in pregnant women who present to the emergency department, both of which can be harmful if left untreated. They go on to say emergency physicians must align around the clear evidence-based guidance for patients. The data from numerous studies have shown that acetaminophen is safe and effective. As always, medication taken during pregnancy should be used only as needed, in moderation, and after the pregnant patient has consulted their doctor. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. They write, more than 20 years of research have shown that acetaminophen is a safe, effective option for managing pain and fever during pregnancy. No high-quality evidence supports any claim that it causes autism in children. The real risk comes from leaving fever or the pain untreated. You should visit your doctor and take at their advice. The American Psychiatric Association, vaccines do not cause autism. Claims of any such association have been repeatedly discredited in peer-reviewed studies. Autism is a complex disorder, and it is incorrect to imply that a handful of studies have established causation. They write, a strong base of evidence shows that acetaminophen, when taken as directed, is safe for use during pregnancy. Any decisions around course of treatment should be determined by a patient and their doctor. Dr. Oz, less than 24 hours after Trump's whatever that was, walked back the advice from the Trump folks, saying that, so the message is not never take Tylenol. It's take Tylenol judiciously. Take it by talking with your doctor. Yeah, yeah. Bill Cassidy, a doctor, a licensed doctor, also pushed back on Trump's advice for pregnant women not to take acetaminophen, saying that the preponderance of evidence shows that this is not the case. I would assume that the good doctor would say, take the drug when consulting a doctor. Now, the weird thing, and this is the reason I've gone through this painstaking layout of all these different groups, and I could spend another hour doing it because they all had the same kind of message. They're crazy. None of this says what they say it says, but you should trust your doctor. You should talk to them. And why is this important? Because what Republicans are doing and what they have done is they're making sure people don't get to see doctors. They're making sure that you don't have a relationship with your doctor because, again, they don't care about you. They don't care about working people, and they sure don't care about children. Because understand, half of the children in this country are born because of Medicaid, of which they've just cut, what, almost $1 trillion from? Which means that there are going to be more mothers who are not getting prenatal care. There are going to be more children who aren't getting the kind of care in the womb that they need. No, because we gotta give tax breaks for rich people, because that's what's important. And all these idiots running around going, vaccines are bad. And that vaccine, they didn't test it enough. You're still here. And this is the weird part in all of this. Yes, there are side effects to anything you touch. You drink too much water, what happens? You drown. This is the weird kind of world that the Trumpites have taken us into. The weird world of prove us wrong. We're going to make all these claims. And this is the Charlie Kirk mastery. You know, prove me wrong. No, you're wrong. This administration is the embodiment of that kind of mentality. They're throwing out all of this bad stuff. And they know they've got the bully pulpit. They know they've got an echo chamber to push this garbage. And the other side doesn't. The weird thing is Americans think vaccines are good. You know, Trump's out of line here. There was a recent Harvard School of Public Health poll. 90% of people that they polled believe routine vaccines are effective in protecting children. 80% say they're safe because they're well tested. 79% say kids should be required to get routine shots to attend school. 90% Democrats, 68% are Republicans, and 72% of parents. What we're doing in this country is we're letting the handful of the minority push their twisted beliefs on the majority. And what we're ending up doing is we're going to cause a public health emergency. And it's going to be self-inflicted because of how crazy this administration is. And just the cuckoo stuff they do. Will we wake up? I hope so. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I know someone's going to tell me, my kid got autism from aspirin. I can hear it. rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. As always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio.
WXCO 1230 AM, W255 DN Wausau.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. The FBI says a gunman who wrote anti-ice on an unused bullet used others to carry out a shooting from the rooftop of a building near a Dallas detention facility. Authorities say the suspect died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Acting ICE Director Todd Lyons tells CBS News agents were trying to help the detainees and adds it was a definite attack on an ICE facility.
That has to be my number one concern right now, is making sure that men and women can go out there, do their mission, but they go home safe to their families.
More from CBS's Nicole Scanlon.
Now, we know that the gunman was firing indiscriminately at the building, including at a transport van in the Sally Port, and it was there that three detainees were shot while they were inside the van. And of course, as we've reported, one has been confirmed deceased while two are in critical condition.
The family of a victim in January's deadly Washington, D.C. plane crash is suing American Airlines, the FAA, and the Army.
The widow of Casey Crafton from Connecticut, Rachel, who was raising three boys.